Right, ladies and gentlemen, good evening. Welcome to this event, which is jointly hosted by the Centre for Environmental Policy and Governance and the Cold War Studies Centre here at LSE. My name is Yvonne Wright, and I'm Director of the Centre for Environmental Policy and Governance. I'm delighted to introduce two speakers of international renown to debate our topic this evening, which is the United States Global Polluter, Kyoto and After. Sir Crispin Tickell is one, if not the foremost authority on climate change. He's had a distinguished career in the diplomatic service and the United Nations, including, I'll take a deep breath here, acting as chef de cabinet to the President of the European Commission, British ambassador to Mexico, permanent secretary of the Overseas Development Administration, which is now DFID, Britain's permanent representative on the UN Security Council, and advisor to no less than three successive British prime ministers. Sir Crispin began studying climate change back in 1975, which, if you think about it, is an extraordinarily prescient move. And he now devotes himself to persuading others of the threat posed by climate change. And I would, at this point, just give a plug for his website, crispintickell.com. It's an incredibly well-organized archive of all his speeches and lectures and articles about him and everything you could want. Our second speaker is Professor Robin Eckersley from the Department of Political Science at the University of Melbourne. Her background is actually as a public lawyer and in constitutional law, but she has been of profound importance in the intellectual study of environmentalism. Her book, Environmentalism and Political Theory Towards an Ecocentric Approach, was seminal in arguing that there was a sound philosophical basis to environmental activism. The last few years seem to be particularly productive, with three books published on the state and the global ecological crisis, political theory and the environmental challenge, and the Green State, Rethinking Democracy and Sovereignty. The format for this evening is that each speaker will talk for about 20-25 minutes, after which there will be time for questions and comments. So with no further ado, I will ask Sir Crispin to start us off. Thank you.
First of all, thank you for asking me and for that very handsome plug. My website was put together by my son, so I can claim no credit for it. But one thing I can assure you is I haven't made this speech before. So it's quite important that I'm not just reading off something that you can read on the website afterwards. Well, the United States, Kyoto, and beyond, I thought it would be quite interesting and useful to begin with a few remarks about the history of all this, because it's something that gets neglected. When I began to be interested in all this at Harvard in the mid-1970s, are you all hearing that's right, is it? In the 1970s, I was regarded either as a pioneer in some quarters or a nutcase in others. And I certainly was quite lucky to have hit on this particular theme of the relationship between climate change on the one side and politics and how we run the world on the other. I must say at that time the bridge between the two was not very good. Indeed, the bridge did not become solid and for quite a long time afterwards. And it's quite interesting if you go back to the early days to see how people first thought about this issue and how the bridge between the two was constructed. As you heard, I did this year at Harvard. I had a fellowship at Harvard for a year, and I chose this as my theme, and I wrote a book about it afterwards. But shortly after that, when I went back to being a diplomat, I was one of the Sherpas, if you know what that is, one of the people who gives advice to a head of state or government at the G7 summit meetings. And I was the representative for Europe when I was working for Roy Jenkins at the European Commission. And as such, I took the opportunity of, in fact, writing a paper on climate change and circulating it in around 1979 or so to my fellow Sherpas, who looked at it with astonishment. Now, in 1977, and this is something frequently forgotten, President Carter commissioned a study which he called the Global 2000, in which he wanted to reflect on what the world would be like in the year 2000. And I sort of helped a bit with this particular report, which was published in 1980. And I just wanted to read to you something that comes into that report. Again, you must remember, this is 1980, looking forward to the year 2000. And what it said was, if present trends continue, the world in 2000 will be more crowded, more polluted, less stable ecologically, and more vulnerable to disruption than the world we live in now. Serious stresses involving population, resources, and environment are clearly visible ahead of us. Despite greater material output, the world's people will be poorer in many ways than they are today. And I must say that in the work on the environment, of course, climate change played a substantial role. So that was a curious thing to look back on that and to consider. When I looked at it again before coming here this evening, I thought to myself how very many of those particular predictions in 1980, in fact, turned out to be just about as correct as you could make them when you look 20 years ahead. Now, throughout the 1980s, there were many workshops and so on in the United States and elsewhere, of course, on climate change. But I think it's fair to say that, in scientific terms, the main leadership came from the United States in the 1980s. At the G7 meeting, I was referring to these groups that you know met the other day last July in Glen Eagles. At the G7 meeting in 1984, partly through my advice to our Prime Minister at the time, we did in fact have a big environmental chapter in which we included climate change. So those who attended the G7 summit at Downing Street in 1984 already had a dose of this subject. It wasn't followed up very much, but then nonetheless the sort of intellectual parameters were established. Then after that, as you probably know, there was enough concern about it in the United Nations for the Intergovernmental Panel to be set up in 1987. And that was odd enough, it was coincided with the first speech I had to make in the General Assembly of the United Nations when I went there as the British Permanent Representative. In 1988, the Prime Minister, then Margaret Thatcher, made a rousing speech on climate change to the Royal Society, which in many ways proved to be a very, very far-sighted thing to have done. It's interesting, the BBC who came there decided to switch off because the subject was so boring, and since then they've been trying desperately to find someone who made a recording of it. Margaret Thatcher likewise came out to New York and she addressed the General Assembly on the subject in 1989, and she attended the Second World Climate Conference, the Second World Environment Summit in 1990s, the World Climate Conference and Summit took place in 1990. And then came, of course, the high point, which was the 1992 meeting at the Rio, the Conference on Environment and Development, and that indeed was something that was very important and, of course, it produced the Framework Convention on Climate Change. But to illustrate feelings in the United States, in 1990, Senator Evans of the state of Washington set up a small group under the umbrella of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences to look into global warming, and I was the only non-American member of that group. And we produced a report in which we called for United States leadership, among other things, and tried again to build more securely that bridge between science and politics. So, coming to the Rio Conference of 1992, that, as you know, produced, not without some difficulty, but nonetheless it produced a framework convention on climate change. And there the key question, I'm just going to read to you, the key objective, which was fully supported by the United States at the time, again partly a product of this run-up of meetings, General Assembly, the Evans Commission report, and so on. The objective was stated, supported by the United States, as to achieve stabilization of greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere at a level that would prevent dangerous anthropogenic interference with the climate system. Such a level should be achieved within a time frame sufficient to allow ecosystems to adapt naturally to climate change, to ensure that food production was not threatened, and to enable economic development to proceed in a sustainable fashion. So that was the sort of high point, 1992, all these things happening, everyone becoming aware of climate change, and a good many rosy rhetorical speeches being made. Well, then came, of course, from 1992 onwards, you begin to see the reaction. There was a five-year review in 1997, before the Kyoto Protocol was signed or even negotiated. There was a review in which a number of people came together to see what had happened since Rio and whether, in fact, the rhetoric of Rio had been translated into action or not. When the parties met in New York for this five-year review, the possibilities were described in terms of two acronyms that I can't resist passing to you. One was called SLUDGE, and that stood for Slightly Less Unsustainable Development, Genuflecting to the Environment. And the other acronym was called DREAMS, or development reconciling environmental and material success. Well, I'm afraid that sludge was rather more effective than dreams. But nonetheless, the momentum wasn't entirely lost, and that led on to the negotiation of the Kyoto Protocol later that year. It's worth remembering, though, at the General Assembly of the United Nations that year, in 1997, President Clinton made the following statement. With 4% of the world's population, we in the United States produce 30% of its greenhouse gases. Frankly, our record since Rio is not sufficient. We must do better, and we will. As it turned out, rather an optimistic statement. Then came the negotiation of the Kyoto Protocol. I'm not going to go into all the details of that because I imagine most of you know what it, or know the essence of what it contained, but very, very briefly, it committed 38 industrial countries, including the United States, to a global carbon dioxide emission reduction target of 5.2% between 2008 and 2012. And the methods to be used included such things as, in the jargon, joint implementation and the clean development mechanism. And these methods meant that non-industrial countries which were not given reduction targets could benefit from investment in clean technologies. For their part, the industrial countries would benefit by having some of their own emissions offset through helping non-industrial countries. But I think everyone agreed when they were drafting the Kyoto Protocol, which is by no means an ideal document, that the real way to reduce carbon emissions is to reduce carbon emissions and just take a decision to aim for a more carbon less intensive society. Now, the language of the Kyoto Protocol was heavily influenced, of course, by the interest in the subject of the vice president of the day, who was Al Gore. And indeed, some of the drafting in it took great advantage of the experience of the United States in reducing sulfur emissions, hence some of the stuff about creating emissions targets and making these various exchanges, and also with the continuing interest of the United States scientific community in trying to look at the whole issue. So the Kyoto Protocol was in many ways an American-tailored document. It was influenced by the United States. It was designed to appeal to the United States. But, as we all know, following Kyoto, the Clinton administration developed what are called cold feet. The Senate was never asked to ratify the protocol. They had passed a rather unhelpful resolution before Kyoto, saying that nothing should be done which would put the United States at a disadvantage with other countries, thereby rejecting the central thesis of the Framework Convention on Climate Change, which was that the industrial countries had prime responsibility for creating the situation, therefore they had prime responsibility in giving leadership to correct it. So, in effect, the protocol was not submitted by the Clinton administration to the Senate, and, as we know, when President Bush Jr. came into office, he announced in a very offhand fashion that he would not submit the thing at all and that the United States would not support the Kyoto Protocol. Again, he claimed that national interest so required him, and again he referred to the fact that many so-called developing countries, non-industrial countries, were not having to accept any obligations under it. Well, since the Kyoto Protocol was signed, and you know it was ratified in February last year, since it was signed, there have been several meetings of the parties, I think 12 meetings of the parties to the protocol. The one at Buenos Aires in December 2003 marked the 10th anniversary of the Framework Convention. I have to say it was not a happy occasion. On the positive side, it looked forward to implementation of the Kyoto Protocol, which is now going forward, and the period after its expiry in 2012. On the negative side, it was marked by obstruction from the United States and, I think you will agree, mischievous performance by its representatives at the negotiations, who did everything they could to muck things up and make it almost impossible to reach any conclusions. So, that's where we stood then. Now, I think one must add just a little word about the traditions of United States unilateralism. It's not new. It's been going on for a very long time. But the tendency has, of course, become much more marked under the administration of the second Mr. Bush. The United States withdrew unilaterally from the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. It failed to ratify the Biodiversity Convention or to accept the Biosafety Protocol. It failed to ratify the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. It refused to accept a new protocol to the Biological and Toxic Weapons Convention. It refused to join the International Criminal Court and has since sought exemption for US citizens who might otherwise be tried under it. And, of course, it did not ratify the Kyoto Protocol. Well, in my experience of being British permanent representative in New York, the five permanent members, including, of course, the United States, did a great many things together. But a member of my staff put it rather well. He said, and this was on all the subjects in the 1980s that came up, he said, there you are, five of you. There's one rather big member who tends to sit in a corner and scratch himself, and if you treat him nicely, he'll come along. But one must object when he starts breaking up the furniture. Well, that in some respects is a good description of what we did in the Security Council at that time. I remember the terrible difficulties we had in getting the United States to agree to launch a war on Saddam Hussein, who had invaded Kuwait, because they didn't like the idea of doing it under United Nations auspices. They wanted to do it really on a unilateral basis. But we eventually persuaded them, but it took quite a lot of doing. Indeed, I think it took Margaret Thatcher a good deal of trouble. She went to see Bush and she seized him by the knee and said, it's time, it is no time, she said, to be wobbly. Right. Well, now, there are many inconsistencies, of course, in all this. One of the kind of beacon cries of the United States is that they believe in free trade and market economics, but as we all know, the administration indulges in a wide variety of subsidies and protectionist measures, as do most countries, and has failed even to respect rulings by the World Trade Organization. Now, opposition to action on climate change falls into this pattern that I've just been describing. It doesn't come only from certain members of the business community. You've heard, I'm sure, about the Christian right, and some of us have seen some rather remarkable statements by the Christian right in some television programs with Richard Dawkins recently. Some even apparently believe that to try and mitigate the effects of climate change might delay the apocalypse and thereby frustrate the will of God. Interesting stuff. Now, I've just been having a word with my fellow speaker, and she's not going to talk a bit about the science, but I think a quick word about the science of climate change might be helpful as illustrating what I'm going to say in a few moments. The first is, of course, that every day that passes, the evidence for climate change, and I'm using that word advisedly, trying to avoid global warming, but we know that it's a code word for global warming, climate change, the evidence for it has increased. Every single edition of Science Magazine, of Nature, of the Scientific American, of the New Scientist, contains evidence of the changes that are taking place. And for that reason, the uncertainties are constantly being reduced. And when the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change produces its next report, which will be in 2007, you will find that the uncertainties will be reduced even more. We have to distinguish natural change from human-driven change. Natural change is always taking place. The only invariable in climate is its variability. But what the conclusions in the third assessment of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is just worth mentioning, when they wrote, in the light of new evidence and taking into account the remaining uncertainties, most of the observed warming over the last 50 years is likely to have been due to the human-induced increase in greenhouse gas concentrations. Now, during the ice ages, of course, the quantity of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere was constantly changing. At the moment, the variation has been between, if you could just remember these figures, between about 190 parts per million during the ice ages and about 280 parts per million during warm periods of the kind that we now live in. But all I would say is that it's now up to 380 parts per million, and there is more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere than for the last 650,000 years. Now, of course, we've tried to see what's going to happen, and prediction is very difficult. All I would say is that we've been identifying what are called tipping points, when you look to see what are the things where you might go over some threshold and create a very new situation, because that's happened many, many times before in the history of the Earth. And the ones that have been distinguished are the state of the Amazonian rainforest, where at the moment there is an unprecedented drought, the direction of the North Atlantic conveyor current, which brings the warm weather to Western Europe and to most of the Northern Hemisphere, changes in the ozone layer, because that, again, is relevant to climate change, the wind-blown effects of Saharan sand, which has increased through human agency on the North Atlantic and its biology, the release of methane clathrates from beneath the tundra and the ocean bed, the frequency of the El Niño-La Niña phenomenon, that which produced or helped to give Katrina its intensity, and the melting of the Greenland and the Antarctic ice shelves. There's been a lot of publicity in the last little while about the Arctic, the Greenland ice shelves. All I can tell you is I went to Antarctica to see things for myself 3 years ago, and while I was there, a large chunk of ice floated off about the size of the Isle of Wight, and when I got back, I was accused of having pushed it. Then you've got, of course, the behavior of the Indian monsoons, and the behavior of the monsoons is absolutely critical to the 1 billion people who live in that part of the world. Now, all this, if carried forward in the ways that it could be carried forward, and there's been an increasing number of scenarios which show big, little, or very big implications, they all impact on the way we run our society. Let me just mention a few. It affects all natural ecosystems. It affects water resources. It affects agriculture and food supplies. It affects human health. It affects human population movement and is likely to produce increasing numbers of environmental refugees. It affects business and industry, transport networks, insurance and banking, town planning, and even building and architecture. And of course, it links with all the other big environmental problems. The incredible quantity of humans that we are now producing. Just to mention, when I was born, there were 2 billion. There are now 6.5. If you know it was rhinoceroses or caterpillars, we'd be scared stupid, but because it's us, we don't. There's the degradation of land taking place, which has been very well illustrated by the United Nations Environment Programme. There's the problems of waste, depletion of resources, water pollution and supply in the oceans and indeed on land, and of course destruction of biodiversity. Well, having told this tale of woe, let me just suggest now that things are in fact changing. I think you'll hear more about it in a few moments, but let me just say this. In the last 2 years, I've seen some considerable changes in attitude all over the world, but particularly and including the United States. It goes partly with this feeling that the United States can't rule the world single-handed. Even Mr. Cheney has agreed with that. The United States has suffered a deep decline in what Joe Nye at Harvard always described to me as soft power. In other words, its moral influence has been greatly diminished by the war in Iraq. But until very recently, climate change was out of this. But now it is definitely changing. The US scientific community is one of the most robust in its work on the subject. It produced a very good document with 14 other National Academies of Science last July. And it has frustrated the efforts to censor the remarks made by scientists in the United States in very forthright fashion. Some of you may have been present at the meeting of the AAAS, as it's called, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, in St. Louis, Missouri last week, but the efforts, the very clumsy efforts of the administration to censor statements on science by such people as, I'm just trying to think of all the people who have been involved, but many have been involved and found that people ring them up saying, you must make this statement, your statements have to be approved before they are made. And that has produced an absolute torrent of complaint last week at this meeting in St. Louis, Missouri. Well, President Bush also is showing signs of change. After a frantic negotiation, he signed the Glen Eagles Agreement last July when the G8 countries met. Now it was G8, not G7. And that said, and this has got Bush's signature underneath it, climate change is a serious and long-term challenge that has the potential to affect every part of the globe. We know that increased need for and use of energy for fossil fuels and other human activities contribute in large part to increases in greenhouse gases associated with warming of the Earth's surface. While uncertainties remain, we know enough to act now to put ourselves on the path to slow and, as the science justifies, stop and then reverse the flow of greenhouse gases. Well, that's a very important statement from the government that didn't agree to ratify the Kyoto Protocol. Business has also moved on. Some of you may have seen, not just in this country, but in the United States, Jeff Immelt of General Electric made a very important statement last summer in which he called for eco-imagination and wishing to apply environmental considerations to almost every aspect of his company's activities. Most of the oil companies have withdrawn from the nasty little lobby that tried to discredit the science which was based in Washington. ExxonMobil is the significant exception. But nonetheless, the others have done so. And within the United States itself, there are many changes taking place. The nine northeastern states, including New York, New Jersey, and Massachusetts, are working towards creating a regional greenhouse gas market. California has enacted legislation to limit carbon dioxide from cars and sports utility vehicles. At the last count, and that was last week, 206 mayors in 38 states, accounting for 42 million Americans, are taking steps to reduce carbon emissions. And state initiatives are important because they can help pave the way for a different attitude on the part of the federal government, and of course they have a great effect on business, and they have a great effect on individuals who are feeling, as people in this country do, that this is a subject of major concern. It's worth remembering that this is what Clinton said in 1997 is still very true. The United States is the biggest polluter. But it's worth remembering that California's emissions exceed those of Brazil, Ohio's emissions exceed those of Turkey, and those from Illinois exceed those of the Netherlands. So it's quite a problem. Now, there's new thinking also, I believe, in the US administration. You'll hear more about this in a moment, but President Bush did refer the other day to the dangers of US addiction to oil, which produced a whole range of scientific articles and the rest on alternatives to oil, including such things as biofuels, and many in the Republican Party are also wobbling. I don't believe that this administration will ever ratify the Kyoto Protocol, but I think that successor administrations, whether Democrat or Republican, almost certainly will take comparable action. There are things that the US administration has done, like entering into agreements with Australia, South Korea, Japan, India, and other countries to lessen the effects and to give help with technology to reduce carbon emissions. Some people said it was an attempt to sabotage Kyoto, but I think we must take the public statements that were made that it was not. It was designed instead to be a supplement to it. Now, I don't want to exceed my time because we're going to hear in a moment from others who are going to spell out these points in more detail, but let me just say what I think should happen in the future. The Kyoto Protocol will expire in the year 2012. I think that we need now to look at things in this way. We need three main requirements required to be met. The first is that any future agreement must be global in character, but with different obligations in different countries in different circumstances. And we have to include India and China in that. One point that you did not make about me is I go to China every year and I give advice to the Chinese government on the environment. We can talk about that later. The second requirement, I believe, is to recognize the vulnerability of different parts of the world to climate change and the need to help in developing and applying new non-fossil fuel energy technologies. And my third point is we need tough enforcement procedures with the possibility of sanctions on offenders. All this will require new thinking and new attitudes. We're unlikely to get those new thinking and new attitudes if we don't satisfy three requirements. The first is we need political leadership. The second is that we need pressure from ordinary citizens, from business, from all aspects of community life. And the third is, and I say it with regret, we usually need something to dramatize it to go drastically wrong where you can safely attribute cause to effect. So, it may be a bit too late to mitigate all the effects of climate change. Where the priority should lie, we shall see. Should it be mitigation? Should it be adaptation? But we've got a hell of a problem on our hands. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Sir Crispin. I'm glad I'm relieved of having to go through the science. The US certainly does stand apart in the global climate change negotiations. We have about 157 states that have now ratified it. And for those states, the Kyoto Protocol really is the only game in town. At the Conference of the Parties and the Meeting of the Parties in Montreal last December, the parties also agreed to embark upon new negotiations for a second commitment period. So amongst the developed world, it's only the US and its deputy sheriff, Australia. Actually, I should mention also Liechtenstein and Monaco. These are the only countries in the developed world that aren't part of these Kyoto commitments. Now, of course, the Bush administration's stance towards Kyoto is part of a broader, more unilateralist posture that Sir Crispin has already explained to us. In fact, we can see the US as helping to downgrade the commitments under all the Earth Summit agreements that were signed up in 1992 at Rio de Janeiro. Bush the Elder refused to sign the Biodiversity Convention. Clinton has since signed that. It hasn't been ratified under Bush. The Cartagena Biosafety Protocol, negotiated under the Convention on Biological Diversity, that hasn't been ratified. And, of course, the Framework Convention itself, which the US is a party to and has ratified. But Bush the Elder bargained his presence at the summit in return for no targets and timetables. But, of course, the first meeting of the parties recognised the weakness of this, and so the Berlin Mandate, as it was called, agreed towards negotiating binding emission targets. But the 1992 and 2002 are kind of two bookends, with Bush the Elder and Bush Jr. showing their lack of commitment to climate change. At the World Summit on Sustainable Development in Johannesburg in 2002, George Bush Jr. wouldn't even leave his ranch to attend the summit. And he actually joined forces with Iran and Iraq and OPEC to strongly oppose a European initiative for a 15% mandatory renewable energy target for all countries. Domestically, of course, the US has lost its leadership role. It was none other than Richard Nixon who presided over some of the most far-reaching environmental legislative initiatives in the 1970s. And not since Jimmy Carter have we really seen an American president that's environmentally concerned and has an internationalist outlook. And the Global 2000 report to the American president referred to by Sir Crispin is a good indication of that. But on the global warming issue, I think this is where the US does stand apart. It's the biggest single aggregate greenhouse polluter in the world, and of course the biggest single per capita polluter as well. Despite that, shortly after winning office, as you all know, George Bush Jr. chose to repudiate the Kyoto Protocol. Now, he cited three reasons then. One was the uncertain science. And as Sir Crispin mentioned at the Gleneagles Summit last year, he's begun to acknowledge that perhaps there is something in the science. But until then, the administration seems to conflate scientific unpredictability with a lack of veracity in the basic hypothesis of global warming. And they're two very different things. All scientists are in agreement that predicting the exact severity, range, and geographical reach of the impacts of global warming is extraordinarily difficult. But the broader hypothesis is becoming increasingly endorsed. The 1990s were the hottest decade since temperatures have been officially recorded. And as Sir Crispin mentioned, the next assessment report produced by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is going to suggest that the consequences, impact, and predicted warming is going to be more severe than what the third assessment report has predicted. The former co-chair of scientific assessment of the UN's IPCC, John Horton, declared in 2003 that global warming is a weapon of mass destruction that's as dangerous as, or at least as dangerous as, chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons, and indeed terrorism. If you look at the predicted consequences of global warming, we're looking at mass extinctions, water, energy, and food scarcity, the loss of coral reefs through bleaching, rising sea levels, of course, coastal and infrastructural damage, human death and suffering resulting from a growing incidence of what we might call weird weather. But it seems a huge irony to me, and a policy puzzle or paradox, that the two most prominent members of the Coalition of the Willing that went into Iraq, who happened to be the world's two highest per capita carbon emitters, the US and Australia, should choose to devote so many of their resources to eradicating WMDs, and yet do so little to address the threat of global warming. The use of WMDs is a possibility. Global warming appears to be now a certainty, not just a mere possibility. So there is a real paradox there that needs explaining. So there is a slight turning of the tides here insofar as George Bush now admits there is something in the science. But the two other remaining reasons that have been publicly given for the repudiation of the Kyoto Protocol still to some extent hold, or still are important and need examination. The next is developing countries and the role of developing countries, which is really just code for China. The argument here is that developing countries are given a free ride, that there's no reciprocity here in the Kyoto Protocol, that America's being asked to make, well, Clinton-Gore administration negotiated an 8% reduction from the 1990 baseline by the 2012 Kyoto deadline. Why shouldn't China, who's producing increasing emissions over time, be asked to do something too? But that argument conveniently ignores the core environmental justice norm that's embedded in the Framework Convention, which frames the negotiations of the protocol, which is a legally binding instrument made under the umbrella of that convention. And that justice norm, called Common but Differentiated Responsibility, was also central to the Berlin Mandate, which set in train the negotiations for the Kyoto Protocol. The basic idea is very simple. Rich nations got rich by exploiting fossil fuel. They should not kick the ladder down behind them and deprive developing countries of their legitimate right to raise the quality of life of their people. So what needs to happen is that the rich nations need to cut some slack for the developing world to catch up, to raise the quality of life of their people. Now, in all his utterances, George Bush Jr. has absolutely and persistently and conveniently ignored this basic environmental justice norm. It's the reason that the Kyoto commitments only apply to the developed world. The understanding is that if those commitments are fulfilled and if further and deeper commitments are made in the second commitment period, then further down the track, the developing world will come on board. But China has led the G77 in adamantly refusing to take on any legally binding commitments until the first world fulfills those initial commitments. The revolution must begin in the affluent society. This is fundamental to the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change and to the Kyoto Protocol, and it is a point that is completely overlooked by the Bush administration. There are two sorts of environmental injustices that we can commit in this world. One is when privileged social classes and nations appropriate more than their fair share of the environment. And the second is when social agents or nations fail to account for the ecological risks that they impose on others. America has committed both of these environmental injustices, and it will not face up to them. Unfortunately, it's going to produce long-term ecological and political blowback. It's going to intensify anti-Americanism, and it's going to ultimately harm Americans. Now, the next reason that the Bush administration has given has to do with its own economy. That the Kyoto targets were unrealistic, that they would impose an unacceptable burden on the American economy, as if moving away from a carbon-based economy ought to be painless. This is the inbuilt assumption there. But insofar as there may be some short-term pain, and I don't deny that there will, we want to see the contraction of the fossil fuel industry. There's no doubt about that. It will be nothing compared to the longer-term consequences of climate change for Americans, as I mentioned, and, of course, the rest of the world. But there is a silver lining to this cloud, too, because if you were to force the pace with green technological innovation and other changes, there are new economic opportunities here. The discourse of ecological modernisation makes this clear, and the Europeans have demonstrated it. Indeed, the Americans have as well, because in the one area where they're particularly stringent in command and control, prescriptive type regulation, is over the remediation of toxic sites. And since the Superfund legislation's been enacted in America, it's forced the pace, and the Americans are now leading the world in toxic remediation and know-how, technology and know-how. So there's nothing like forcing the pace through strict regulation to generate massive technological innovation. The problem with the Bush strategy is it assumes that this can be done through voluntary initiatives. Now, of course, when Bush repudiated the protocol, he assumed it would collapse. He thought that other countries would be secretly relieved of their commitments and burdens and the whole thing would dissolve. But, of course, exactly the opposite has happened. The Bush administration said that the Kyoto Protocol was flawed and unrealistic, and that it would propose a range of alternatives that would better address the problem. Now, although I'm personally committed to multilateralism, I'm prepared to accept that some multilateral treaties may be flawed and ineffective and ultimately not address the problem. And that in those kinds of instances, I wouldn't disparage alternative initiatives that got to the heart of the problem, that went much further in trying to address it, even if it involved building alternative coalitions of the willing to produce a more concerted strategy. However, the Bush alternative has been laughable. Let's look at the domestic initiatives before we look at some of the foreign policy initiatives. The centrepiece of the Bush climate change strategy is to reduce the greenhouse gas emission intensity of the American economy by around 18% by 2012. Now, this sounds pretty impressive. 18%? Didn't the Clinton-Gore administration negotiate an 8% cut? But this is a very, very misleading measure. What it measures is the intensity of greenhouse gas emissions per unit of GDP. And this intensity has been falling naturally over time. And by the government's own admission, the intensity of the greenhouse gas intensity of the American economy was predicted to fall by 14% by that target. So the stretch target of 18% wasn't really pushing it out much further. Besides which, the Bush government has no clear measures to ensure the implementation of that policy and to know that if in fact that emission intensity improved, whether it had anything to do with government policy at all or whether it was just part of this long-term trend. So the Bush's policy seeks to contribute to global warming slightly more efficiently than in the past. But of course, this wimpy climate change strategy has been more than overshadowed by the National Energy Strategy, which is all about stepping up exploration and extraction of oil in America, including in national parks. And this has been followed up with Bush's new energy bill, passed in July 2005, which includes huge subsidies to the American oil and gas industry, plus subsidies, low-interest loans and research grants for the development of nuclear power plants, or as what Bush calls nuclear power plants. He does have some money there for renewables, I grant him that, for increased use of ethanol and so forth. But there are no measures to increase fuel efficiency standards for cars or for SUVs. As one Democrat wag quipped, the only energy-saving measure in the bill was the extension of daylight saving from 2007. Turning to the international initiatives, the basic strategy here, which is a very familiar one, is one of creating bottom-up ad hoc coalitions of the willing on specific issues. So this has included a range of specific bilateral partnerships and some regional partnerships, the most significant of which is the Asia-Pacific Climate Pact that Sir Crispin has referred to, with Australia, China, India, North Korea and Japan. Now together, these countries account for more than 50% of global emissions, so this is not an insignificant initiative. However, it's basically about promoting voluntary technological transfer, exchange, research, focusing particularly on clean coal and geosequestration. There are no targets, no timetables, no compliance mechanisms, and it pretty much reflects the US's own preferred approach here. Now, I'm not knocking it. It's good insofar as it goes. But at the inaugural meeting of this pact in Sydney earlier this year, by the way, the EU apparently requested observer status but was refused, the Australian Bureau of Agriculture and Resource Economics, which does a lot of modelling studies for the current government, predicted that if this pact was implemented in its entirety, emissions would be reduced by around 23% from a business-as-usual scenario by 2050. Sounds good? But buried also in the report is the confession that these emissions will still be 100% higher than what they currently are by 2050. Now, just bear in mind that the IPCC says we need to reduce atmospheric concentrations of greenhouse gases somewhere in the order of 60 to 80% if we're to stabilise the world climate. And this pact is going to oversee, well, it's going to do very little to see emissions raised by 100% by 2050. So the problem here is not simply America's turn away from multilateralism, because if its unilateralism was deep green, it would not be so problematic. Now, of course, the Bush administration has sought to impugn the Kyoto Protocol and has poked at the EU for being unlikely or unable to fulfil its targets. And that there is a little bit of the EU is a little vulnerable there, but it is too soon at this stage to see whether the Kyoto commitments will be fully realised. However, although the 5.2% cuts under the Kyoto Protocol are laughable when set against the magnitude of the problem, you need to understand that this is setting in train a framework. After more than a decade and a half of painstaking negotiations, we now have an agreed-upon framework through which we can start ratcheting up those commitments. So while 5.2% as an average cut from the developed world is laughable, George Bush's alternative strategy is much more laughable. And as Elizabeth Desombre wryly noted, the very fact that the US refuses to follow the Kyoto Protocol is itself a sign that it has at least some bite. Okay, so what are the implications of the US withdrawal? Well, it's going to undermine the Kyoto Protocol in a number of ways. The first and most obvious one is that the US is the biggest single per capita and aggregate emitter, and not to have it part of that bargain is a real disappointment. It really does need to be part of the solution. A second, less direct effect is that it's going to partly undermine some of the Kyoto mechanisms. It's going to affect the market structure under which emission tradings will take place. Now, when Russia negotiated its target, the baseline was 1990, and its economy has contracted quite a good deal since then. So it has some slack there. It's what we call hot air. It has hot air to trade. And it was hoping to trade a lot of that with the US, and it was one of the reasons it dragged its feet in ratifying. The fact that America is not a player in this market is going to drive down the cost of these tradable permits, which means that countries who are unable to meet their targets are more likely to buy their way out of the problem rather than reduce emissions at source. So you need a higher price for this system to really work. Thirdly, until the US takes the lead, we can't expect to see much action from China. As I said, China has led the G77 in steadfastly holding to those environmental justice norms. And although China will have to be part of the solution, and I agree with Sir Crispin as well on that score, and there is a moral difference here, because in America's favour, I would say that it began its exploitation of fossil fuels without knowing what the consequences would be, and there's now so much sunk capital in that. China is moving full steam ahead modernising, knowing full well what the consequences are. So it does need to take some responsibility for that. At the same time, I think that the US does need to make the first move, because there is this agreed framework to which China is a party, and it will hold America to that, and it will hold the developed world to that framework. So on grounds of justice, America does need to make the first move here. Now, this is a problem, because if there is a standoff here, instead of a Cold War between the US and the USSR, what we might face, we may face the daunting prospect of a warming war between the US and America. US and China. And it is predicted that China will overtake America at some point in the future as the biggest aggregate emitter. But this analogy with the old Cold War arms race is really rhetorical. It's a little misleading, because there is a huge disparity in the per capita greenhouse gas emissions of these two major countries. According to World Resource Institute figures, 2001 figures, the average American emits around 8 times as much CO2 as the average Chinese. And again, this is one of the facts that America seems to want to conveniently ignore. The problem for America is that it's become so dependent upon cheap oil. And it's continued to impose extremely negligible fuel taxes. The US preoccupation with stepping up domestic production and securing foreign supplies, including by force, rather than managing and reducing domestic demand, is the greatest failing of US environmental policy. The absolutely greatest failing. On the one hand, you have Congress working hard to block any efforts to raise domestic oil prices, on the one hand, and then you've got the executive playing a major role in foreign petroleum policy, framing it as a matter of security and utilising the full range of diplomatic, intelligence and military resources at the disposal of the executive, which of course don't always operate under the full glare or the normal channels of democratic oversight. So you've got this weird combination of the legislature being quite intransigent and the American executive having to secure supply. So it's a supply-driven policy rather than a demand management policy. So the Americans have pursued this short-term logic of maintaining their relative economic gains with an eagle eye on their relative economic efficiency compared to China, and it's been supply-driven rather than demand-driven. And this is the policy that needs to be exactly reversed, with an interlocking ecological security policy and an ecological modernisation policy, which will together move America away from a carbon-based economy. And given that the US is the world's biggest economy, the international repercussions would be enormous and positive for Americans and the rest of the world. This means drastically curbing petroleum consumption, fossil fuel consumption in general, bearing in mind the immense environmental costs and security costs associated with a heavy reliance on imported oil. If American oil consumption rates were comparable to those of Europe, Western Europe, it would not have to import 55% of its oil, and it could even become a marginal exporter. Okay, now I don't have time to explain in depth. I'm running out of time here, but there's a number of reasons why the Americans haven't really taken the initiative here. The Bush administration's been absolutely preoccupied with 9/11, terrorism, and the war in Iraq, and its more general aversion to multilateralism is certainly evinced here. Of the 41 multilateral environmental agreements negotiated, this is a UNEP report, 31 have been adopted just since 1985, and most of them in the post-Cold War period, that is, after the Berlin Wall fell. And they've followed a pattern of a framework convention and then protocol. They've had more NGO involvement, and it's been a painstaking process where they set out the principles first, and then they haggle over the distribution of benefits and burdens. But it's a process of ongoing negotiation. Then these multilateral environmental negotiation becomes a permanent feature under each of these arrangements. It gives relatively more voice to NGOs and a lot of other forms of multilateralism. It creates strong normative expectations, but it limits the hand of more powerful players. This principle of common but differentiated responsibility looks to the US to provide the lion's share of funding and technology transfer, and to the extent to which the Americans conform with that, their discretion is tied in other areas. Their ability to act unilaterally is tied up. These MEAs are becoming more sophisticated. They're reaching more and more into domestic areas of energy, transport, finance, taxation, which are seen to encroach more on sovereignty. Certainly that's the way the Americans see it. One of the purposes of American foreign policy is generally been to get other nations to accept and follow their values. And in the Cold War period, this was relatively easy because the US and the Europeans shared a common threat. They were united in their opposition to communism. But since the end of the Cold War, their threat perceptions have changed. Their conceptions of risk have changed. Their priorities have changed. So America can't get its own way through multilateral institutions. And so it's preferring to build coalitions of the willing. There are also many domestic blockages. This policy area, more than many others, is highlighting the weaknesses of the American democratic system, the fragmentation, the standoff between the executive and the legislature, because the executive needs two-thirds congressional approval to ratify treaties. In fact, much of the initiative for implementing new energy policy doesn't lie with the president. It lies with Congress. But their complicated committee system is vulnerable to special interest pleading, particularly by the fossil fuel industry. The American environment movement has lost its dynamism. It was extremely dynamic in the 70s, but in a pamphlet circulated in 2003 at a meeting of the American Grantmakers Association called The Death of Environmentalism, it's been argued that it's become sclerotic, that it's focused on small-scale technical policy shifts by Washington lobbyists, that it has no grassroots basis, it has no visibility in the suburbs, like the conservative Christian churches, that it hasn't built alliances with labour. The American auto industry, for all its problems, provides comprehensive health insurance to its workers. The American environment movement needs to grapple with those issues, work proactively with the auto industry. Okay, so is the tide turning? I'll try and wind up in 1 minute. There are some glimmers of hope here. The Gleneagles Summit, acknowledgement, there's something in the science. There is a gradual shift in Congress. The number of new initiatives dealing with climate change have grown, the most significant of which is the Lieberman-McCain Climate Stewardship Act, which tried to introduce a fairly modest cap-and-trade system. Defeated, but narrowly. Hurricane Katrina, I think, has left a very deep imprint on the American imagination. It gives us a good indication of what's likely to happen to the lumpen uninsured with these weird weather events. Another glimmer of hope at the Montreal COP last year, the Americans agreed reluctantly to engage in non-binding discussions on climate change. This is outside the second commitment, Kyoto negotiations, following an impassioned speech by Clinton. This was the first time when a COP had been held in North America. And I think that was important because there was a big display of American media and it was well reported. And I think this is a good development. Bush's recent State of the Union address says America is addicted to oil, which is often imported from unstable parts of the world. We need to replace more than 75% of our oil imports from the Middle East by 2025. This is deeply encouraging. It's just if you read on, it didn't say that we won't secure our supplies from elsewhere, and it says nothing about weaning America off cheap prices. Okay, the way forward. I think the EU can do a lot. It can extend its emissions scheme to the American states. A number of Australian states have talked with northeastern states in America about a carbon trading scheme because our government in Australia refuses to introduce a national cap and trade system. It could also invest in environmental capacity building at the state level in America. As I said, American environmental NGOs can do a lot more. They can woo labour. They can also woo business. The American majors have very little investment in renewables relative to some of the European oil companies like BP or Shell. And both of those companies actually acknowledge global warming and are beginning to diversify, whereas the American majors have joined a major coalition to impugn the science and to threaten and spook Americans with job losses. So NGOs need to work not just in Washington, they need to work with labour and they need to work with business. A two-pronged strategy of shaming them from the outside, wooing them, coercing them, and inducing them from the inside. Americans must get over the idea that regulation means a big brother state. Strict regulation is the best way to force technological innovation. And finally, we need some kind of face-saving rapprochement between the US and China. The Asia-Pacific Partnership is a kind of feeble attempt in this direction, but much more is needed to end this warming war. Sadly, it's probably going to be rising oil prices that are going to follow the age of peak oil and probably a few more Katrinas that might actually turn things around. The tragedy is that it may well be too late for many ecosystems and many vulnerable communities.
Well, many thanks to our speakers. We've now got some time for questions and for comments. There are roving mics upstairs and downstairs. Can I ask you please to keep your question or comment reasonably brief? Okay. I'll take one from the upstairs first.
In 1975, as now, climate change was a great problem, so the overwhelming majority of scientists said. It was reported that it was a massive and urgent problem. The evidence, like now, was arising so rapidly that meteorologists could not keep up with it. It was essential, like now, that action would be taken at once, or otherwise that the dangers would become a grim reality. Now, the only thing that wasn't like now is that the disaster about which all the scientists were warning us was a rapid cooling to lead to a new ice age. So I think some skepticism is justified. And there was a very, very distinguished panel of the House of Lords reported last year and attacked in language which I'd have thought was unusual for the House of Lords, the International Panel on Climate Change, accusing them of political bias, failing to take proper account of costs, failing to take proper account of the benefits of global warming. So I think it's a pity that as well as our two distinguished speakers, we haven't had one of the scientists who can argue the other side.
Okay. Thank you. Can I ask you to respond to that?
You paint a somewhat misleading picture, if I may be so bold. In 1975, when I was writing my book on the subject, I went and I consulted almost every scientist there was. There was indeed, at that time, a group of people who believed that global cooling was more important than global warming. But the issue was undecided, and in the book I wrote, I very carefully laid out the arguments each way. So there was no, there was no majority for saying it was going to be cooling, they just didn't know. And of course that, in some respects, remains today. There are many uncertainties, and those uncertainties continue. So I don't think it's fair to say that that in 1975 the world was alerted to climate change. I do assure you it wasn't. And it was quite difficult to get my voice heard at the time. And when we finally produced it in the G7, it was a very strange and unwelcome introduction to what was called what was then the world of politics. So the science was divided, but since 1975, the science has become very different. And in the successive reports of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, I think that the position has been laid out very clearly, and it will be even more clearly in the next one in 2007. As for the House of Lords report, frankly, it was a bit of a joke, because it really was not a serious report. There were one or two people with bees in their bonnets and their eyes gleaming who were determined to not to listen to what was said to them, but to produce a biased report, which frankly has had no resonance at all. You should instead look at the proceedings of the Exeter conference, which brought everything up to date in February last year, and the publication of papers only in the last two or three weeks, which carry this forward, and indeed in the constant evidence being produced from the scientific community, in which the United States plays a major role. So it's not quite like that, and I don't think that their lordships really were very well informed, and most people have simply ignored the report that was made. Thank you.
Can the panel therefore highlight why it took the House of Lords a little bit of time to get around the problem, and then ask Sir Nicholas Stern to give an account of the opportunities for more economically applied thinking over the next 10 years. Why it's taken this long to get a panel of people together to even advise our government in this country, let alone the American government, how the science and the economics can be tied up for public benefit. And I'd really like to understand that. Thanks.
I'm afraid it's rather a comment on our system of government. And one of the great difficulties has always been, as Margaret Thatcher herself has said several times, not least to me, was that most people in her cabinet had a different kind of education. They didn't think in scientific terms. And that is perfectly true about most of the people in both the House of Lords and the House of Commons. But they aren't listening. If they listen to what comes out of the Royal Society and successive presidents of the Royal Society, if they listen to what's said at the British Association for the Advancement of Science every year, if they listen to the British institution run by Susan Greenfield, who've done a series of debates on the subject, you'd find that they are dealing with a situation which no longer exists. And there are, it must be said, some members of the House of Lords who have been doing their best to try and put this right. They also try and do it in the House of Commons. I've given evidence myself to a number of institutions in which I've found that rather as when you are discussing with bishops the concept of human stewardship of the earth, you have to start from a rather low point on the graph.
Robin, did you want to address that in Australia?
No.
Professor Eckersley did mention peak oil briefly, but what is the panel's view on the predicted peak in world oil production within the next 5 years, and whether that, in fact, will have much more impact on human life in the short to medium term than global warming ever could have?
I'll briefly comment, and I'm sure Sir Crispin has something to say on this too. Oil is only one fossil fuel, so the arrival of peak oil won't stop the world from using coal, which is in fact the worst offender when it comes to greenhouse gas emissions. And peak oil doesn't mean that oil will suddenly run out. It just means the point at which we're exploiting the maximum after that there'll be less available. It'll gradually start declining. So it won't be sudden, but it will lead to a gradual rise in prices in oil. And there aren't many substitutes around for the transport industry. You know, there's biofuels that are now being looked into, but oil has this wonderful capacity to be easily transportable. Yes, that will start to change things. There's no doubt about it. And the best thing to do is start shifting your investment now and get that lead edge in finding alternatives. Ethanol, I haven't looked at all the studies about the greenhouse gas implications of ethanol. Perhaps Sir Crispin does, but it's going to have huge implications for transport. In a seminar earlier today, we were discussing the growth in aviation, and that's certainly going to contribute hugely to greenhouse gas emissions. We may have to start getting used to the idea of travelling less in aeroplanes. It's certainly the simplest solution.
Well, I haven't got very much to add to that. I always believe myself that the fundamental requirement is a proper assessment of costs. You will hear from many people that this form of energy is more expensive than that form of energy. And for that reason, we shouldn't, for example, get into one area, or we should not get into another. At the moment, there are still massive subsidies going into fossil fuel exploitation, and particularly that has been the responsibility of the Bush administration. There has also been subsidies going into other forms of energy. Well, I've got nothing against subsidies going into different forms of energy, but it has to be done within a framework carefully established of the public interest. Where should we give our subsidies? And I think myself that when the government produces its energy review, that's in Britain, in July, it will begin to explore some of these issues, above all of cost, how you can compare costs in a sensible fashion. I just want to say one word further. Nuclear cost is very expensive in terms of capital investment. It is relatively cheap in terms of performance. And to make these comparisons is very different. But I'm sure, as I've said to another audience in the LSE on another occasion, we really need to look at some of the economics which underlie a lot of our thinking about energy. And above all, try and escape from the kind of what I can only describe as the prison of thinking about growth, GNP, GDP, and the rest. And there, China has been a conspicuous force for innovation and new thinking.
Can I just add to that? There's a golden rule with cost-benefit analysis, and that is the more you lengthen the time horizon with which you conduct the calculations, and the more you put all of the cards on the table facing up, that is, not just the economic costs, but the ecological and social costs, you invariably move towards a more risk-averse approach and a greener approach. You take nuclear, okay, the operational costs are relatively cheap, but the immense capital investment in setting it up, and no one can calculate the costs of decommissioning nuclear power stations, not to mention the problem of intractable waste and the problem of proliferation. These are really difficult, but if you do start to put some figure on it, it never looks economic. When you lengthen that time horizon over how many generations, when you think of the intractability of nuclear waste.
I would like to thank very much both speakers for excellent speeches, very enlightening over here.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. I would just like to ask perhaps a banal question, but an important question nevertheless, is I'm kind of wondering, both of you mentioned that there's a change in the trend in that the U.S., even the U.S., now with the Eagle Report, is actually has signed this report. Do you think it is actually a change in the trend, or is it rather more lip service, the country, the USA, paying lip service to something that it can't avoid in without losing face? So do you actually think it is a genuine trend towards the better, or is it just the sort of hypocrite signature?
Well, I would just say that I think that it's not pure hypocrisy. It is a genuine feeling that maybe mistakes have been made and that we have to think again. What I take particular comfort in is the fact that the contenders for the presidential race 3 years from now, particularly John McCain, whose legislation you referred to, and indeed Hillary Clinton, if it is she, but it could be somebody else, of course. The attitudes of the Republican Party has changed. The attitudes of the Democrats has always been roughly where it is now, although they've been faulted for lack of performance rather than lack of good intentions. So what I think is interesting, and that's why I referred to it in my talk, is the way in which so many cities have taken this up, because people are beginning to see exactly what the effects could be and how bad they could be. I mean, I go to the United States quite often. I'm going to Arizona in 2 weeks' time. There we will find that they're very concerned about the changes in water patterns. You go to the Northeast, they're very concerned about drought. You go to other parts of the U.S., and they're all very worried about different things. And so that is why so many ordinary people are now beginning to think about it. And ordinary people in the United States, as in other democratic societies, do actually wield a lot of influence. And then you've got to add on what I was saying before about business, the way in which so many business enterprises can read the writing on the wall rather better than some of the people in Washington, D.C. So I think there is I think changes are taking place. How fast they'll move, I don't know. But I'm sure they are taking place. And I think that the test of it in many respects is going to be the negotiation of the protocol following 2012.
I would just like to add to that American society is quite divided between the so-called blue and green red states. And there's a lot of Americans who are very frustrated with their president's policy, particularly the foreign policy. And it won't take much of a shift for that to swing round and be reflected in policy. So Crispin's also right, there's a lot of things happening at the city and municipal level, and interestingly enough, that's where you get the biggest showing of green parties throughout the country, at the municipal level, because the electoral system is conducive to that. The national electoral system is deeply unconducive. In fact, Ralph Nader has a great deal to answer for in the 2001 result, because he could have swung valuable votes back. Had he not stood, Al Gore could well be president today. Yes, there's a lot of things happening within American society, and it won't take that much to flip it round and to be registered in national politics. There's still a lot of other sclerotic features in American politics, so I don't want to be Pollyannish about it, but I don't think some of these changes that we've been talking about are mere lip service.
Yeah, I have a question about the role of Britain and the EU. If I remember correctly, Britain has actually reduced its targets on CO2 emissions. And how does that go with the Prime Minister's pledge to take a leading role in combating climate change? And the second question, where should Europe or the world community draw a line in making compromises on climate change? You explained how the Kyoto Protocol was already designed to please the United States when they then did not sign it. What is worse, making more, watering it down more to get America on board, or going ahead with ambitious targets without the US?
What was your first point? Sorry,
British targets.
About British targets. Yes, the government, I'm sorry to tell you, has made rather an ass of itself. Because what they did was that they put in a bid, and then the DTI and the CBI and all the rest of it all came forward and said, no, that's far too low. We're going to be disadvantaged. There was then the commission was then operating, and they had a court case, and they are now reviewing the levels. But that was only refers to the first phase up to the year 2007. From 2007, they're going to have to negotiate new caps on carbon emissions, and from then the situation will change. Now, what I've been saying to the government is that they have, in fact, made a mess of their own publicity, because they're not so stupid as they look, if you see what I mean. And therefore, they really should be making more of an effort to put out what they're actually doing. The current arrangements are very, very brief. They only relate to this year. It will be different in 2007. Now, what can the EU do in all this? Well, the EU, I've believed this for a long time, should go for something like a carbon tax, an EU-wide carbon tax, rather than worry so much about carbon emissions. A carbon tax would be a very good way of dealing with some of the issues, because, as you've heard, some of the EU countries are much better than others in meeting their EU targets. By and large, the Scandinavians, the British and the Germans are going to fulfill their targets, but the southern Mediterranean countries haven't yet really taken the measures necessary to fulfill theirs. And so it's a nice question as to whether we're going to meet the global EU target or whether we're not. Britain will more than meet its target, although it won't meet what the Prime Minister has called the aspirational target of 2012, which I think is a 20% reduction. So there's a great deal of to-ing and fro-ing on this question. I believe the EU has got to give the example in this respect, because they are the constant reproach. And in many ways, it shows that when you do take these measures, even if they can be painful in the very short term, they usually lead to greater industrial efficiency and competitiveness in the longer term. And so the argument which was used by the Bush administration that it's going to hurt the American economy is frankly nonsense. And those who adopt these various measures of reducing carbon emissions are not only doing future generations a good turn, but they're probably actually going to make more money out of it. And I think it's very important that case should be more eloquently made.
I would just like to add to that. The impassioned speech that Bill Clinton gave at the Montreal meeting was precisely that. It said that the Bush administration argument that reducing carbon emissions would harm the American economy was dead wrong. And that was widely reported throughout the media. And that was the second last day of the conference. And the next day, the Bush negotiators agreed. They kind of backed down and decided they will engage in non-binding discussions in the future. But you asked a very profound question. And I think that's the question about, do we water down the regime to bring the Americans on board, or do we proceed with a more stringent regime without the Americans? This was a really difficult issue that the European negotiators have had to face, a very difficult issue. And they already had produced a whole range of flexibility mechanisms that appease the Gang of Four, which includes Australia. But I think a point is reached where you have to go ahead without America and show the way. And I think everything does depend on the Europeans. And if their emission trading scheme doesn't really work, because at the moment there's been some over-allocations, which will mean it will perform below par, it's really important that the Europeans succeed in that initiative and in their other, complementary measures, because that will ratchet things up. It's about leadership. It's about setting an example. And the Europeans have been the green leaders in these negotiations ever since, particularly since Kyoto. So it's a profound question. It was a fine judgment as to when to kick off without America, when to keep diluting to include them. Australia extracted some extraordinary concessions in the 11th hour of negotiations at Kyoto. In fact, there's a clause in Kyoto, in the protocol, called the Australia Clause, because it really only benefits Australia. And it means, the clause says that you can include in your calculations emissions from land clearing. Because there's very high amounts of land clearing going on in Australia, particularly in the state of Queensland, which were destined to start falling, but that was after the 1990 baseline, that meant we had this free ride, and so we need to do nothing to reduce emissions at source to reach our Kyoto target. But we're still overshooting anyway. And we have this schizophrenic position in Australia, which is the government says we will not ratify Kyoto because it's flawed, but we'll do everything we can to reach our Kyoto target. But the target is so laughable because Australia was only one of three developed countries that were allowed an actual increase in emissions. It's a farce, an absolute farce.
Can I ask one question on technology and one question on a legal issue? So Crispin, I understand you've been to China, and I've just come back as well. I understand that they're planning to build 500 coal-fired power stations in the next few years. Roughly how long does it take to build a coal-fired power station, and do you think carbon capture and storage might be developed in time to at least sequester some of that carbon? And on a legal issue with the estates, the plight of the polar bear is close to my heart, and it's felt that within the end of the century they may be extinct due to melting ice flows. They're starving and not reaching breeding weights, so the population is in decline. There's a legal wrangle at the moment to declare them as an endangered species, but for that to get on the record, you have to say why are they endangered, and that would mean the Arctic recognising there may be anthropogenic reasons for that.
Maybe I knew the answer to the second question. Can you deal with the second question? Well, on the first question about China, let me respond. I belong to a body called the China Council for International Cooperation on Environment and Development, and we meet once a year in Beijing or indeed elsewhere in China, and this particular body is a state body of the Chinese government, and we always have access to the top, and we are roughly half Chinese, half foreign, and I've done this now since 1992. Now, during that period, I've noticed the degree to which the Chinese government has been demonized by the United States in particular, and is blamed for all sorts of things, like daring to improve its economy and daring to do all a whole lot of things that most of us would regard as perfectly reasonable things for the Chinese to do. When you come to the Chinese environment policy, I've always found that there's a terrible gap, and this is fully admitted by the Chinese leadership, between what the Chinese leadership wants to do and what actually happens right down at the bottom of the pile. The Chinese at the moment are very anxious to reduce their emissions of carbon. They have reduced their dependence on coal by a substantial percentage. I think it used to be something between 70 and 80%. They're now down to about 60%. They've also got a whole lot of measures in place to try and find ways of dealing with coal gasification and reducing the carbon-emitting effect of coal, and they have a substantial technical program to do that. But of course, that means that's why the Chinese have been fanning out all over the world to try and find energy from other sources, including, I may say, Australia. So it's quite interesting that the Chinese have a domestic policy to reduce their carbon emissions and, above all, reduce their dependence on coal, and at the same time to try and assure their energy supplies for the next 50 years or so, which is why Chinese have been up in Spitsbergen seeing if they can buy into some of the things that may be there. They've been right down in South Africa, they've been in Nigeria, they've been all over the world because they wish to ensure their future energy viability. Simultaneously, they've been putting a lot of money into alternative sources. The new pebble bed technology, a nuclear reactor, which is a very interesting experiment, is about to open in China. They've got something like 30 nuclear power stations on order. And they are taking this problem extremely seriously. When I was there in November, I had a very good exchange with the Chinese Prime Minister Wen Jiabao on exactly these issues, in which he quite freely said that the great difficulty was to get the message conveyed to the right levels in the very complicated management structures of China. All I would say is that over the last 14 years when I've been doing this, we have seen quite a notable effect. We have actually had some influence, and I think we've had some influence above all in trying to judge environmental costs, and hearing what Professor Eckersley said about looking at cost differently, redefining growth, redefining, seeing the value of GNP, GDP, in fact trying to go for other ways of measuring prosperity, and above all the human aspect, not just producing things but actually increasing the sum of human happiness, to put it at its most crude. And there the Chinese again have done things that have not been done elsewhere. So I think that far from demonizing China, we should be giving China all encouragement we can to proceed in these directions. Now, I don't know whether you want to refer on the other point.
One footnote to what you just said about China. The Chinese are courting the Australian government now to purchase more of our uranium. Australia has abundant supplies. And they're also wanting to set up actual plants in the Northern Territory rather than just buy the raw material. So that's something we're all watching very closely. Well, our former Prime Minister, Bob Hawke, suggested we become a disposal site for the rest of the world because we've got this big desert. Yes, that didn't go down very well, the Australian population. But I'd like you to say a little more about this polar bear. I didn't quite get the connection. Is someone wanting to sue someone, or is it... I see. Right. Well, that raises... I can't answer that particular case, but it raises much more interesting legal questions. We know the asbestos industry and the tobacco industry are being slowly crippled through litigation. And perhaps the time will come when the fossil fuel industry will start to be hit with lawsuits. Of course, tracking that chain of causation is going to be infinitely more complex, but as the science becomes more refined, perhaps that becomes a possibility. I know some Pacific Island states have been working on bringing actions against America because they could disappear. I mean, it's hard to think of a bigger security threat than have your entire nation submerge. Well, they would like to. They would need to come up with something different, wouldn't they? But all I can say that, as lawyers would say, they're nice legal questions, and I'm watching with great interest to see whether those sorts of issues are raised, because once that begins, you can get a, dare I use the analogy, floodgates would be opened, and that would it would introduce a whole new ball game. Because the fossil fuel industry knows, just like the asbestos and tobacco industry knew for years and years what the consequences of their products were. And it is one way to get them.
I know there are a lot of people who would still like to ask questions, but I think we're going to have to draw to a close, I'm afraid, approaching 8 o'clock. I think it's been a fascinating debate and a number of wide-ranging number of questions raised, and I really think we should conclude by thanking our speakers for answering them all so thoroughly and such interesting points. Thank you very much.